this case and counsel in future cases that if you really expect us to read and entertain this information, it ought to be provided in sufficient time where we can do so. You are therefore instructed that you are not to argue anything from either the supplement or the response this morning. You may proceed.
Thank you, Justice Hardesty. May it please the Court, Dan Pulsenberg for the appellant, Raymond Corey. Your Honor, let me address the supplemental authorities first, because normally it is our practice to follow the old rule and file supplemental authorities about 14 or 15 days before argument. And normally the Court gives us 6 weeks advance notice. And unfortunately in this case we only had 3 weeks notice. And we don't usually, I know that this Court has adopted the federal rule, and I know the Ninth Circuit has conniptions when they get a 28J letter the morning of argument. And we try to get it done as early as possible. But without the advance notice that we usually get, we were just not able to do that. We even emailed the other side with our proposed supplemental authorities so they'd have an advance chance to get to take a look at it. It's simply something, and I don't usually do it, simply something that couldn't be avoided under the circumstances of the scheduling, and so I apologize. The case. This case presents quite a number of issues, a number of issues that normally would be considered to be too many to do an appeal. One of the brief lists nine arguments. I think we can group them really into three. And there are three types of issues that are tactics that are done at trial they're the prevailing tactics now. One could almost say these are the greatest hits of what people are doing at trial to get an advantage. And that's why it's a good thing that they're all raised together, and it does make the point of it being a cumulative error, a point made in the opening brief and also in the supplemental authorities. And let's address as many as we can in the 13 minutes we have left. I think the most pressing issue, and the issue that probably stands on its own the best, is the jury selection issue. This is a case where the jury was asked about $2 million. Now, I've been in a lot of jury selection cases, and I've seen people being asked, well, could you award $1 million? And they express hesitancy. And yet they're still able in those cases, I'll admit, to award $4 or $5 million. But in this case, the questioning went far further. I was at a seminar in New York in September, and it talked about the judicial hellholes. And it said one of the prevailing characteristics of them is that it allows jury anchoring. It allows, when you're asking questions during voir dire, to raise a number. And not just raise a number, because some of the cases that respondents cite talk about raising a number, raising $1 million or raising multi-million dollars. But here it was repeated and repeated, even to the point where Mr. Fitzgerald, one of the potential jurors, said, why are you bullying with us with this? So it's an improper thing to do is to anchor a number, to use jury selection as a way to argue for a number and reinforce it. Again, as a potential juror said, almost like practicing for a classroom for a pop quiz.
Well, Mr. Pulsar, I understand that, but the court has the discretion to run jury selection. The defense attorneys get up and talk about McDonald's coffee and all this. So, you know, this goes both ways here on it. How did the court abuse its discretion in not cutting this off in your mind?
Two ways. First of all, it should have been cut off. It should have just been asked the question. I understand why people want to know, do you have a problem awarding a lot of money? I was in a case once where the jury was asked, do you have problems awarding $2 billion? But it didn't stop at that question. It kept going. It went to, as we said and as they criticized us for saying, an indoctrination. But it went even further than that, far further than that, because in this case, there were 10 challenges for cause that Judge Weiss granted. One of them was stipulated. One of the plaintiffs was stipulated. One of them, I thought, two of them the judge said, okay, they say they have trouble with pain and suffering. I'm going to exclude them for cause. One, Mr. Walker, juror number 34, I thought that one was a little close to the line, sort of like the juror in Jitnan versus Oliver. But the other five, the judge originally denied the challenge for cause. Plaintiff argued and said, look, you can't get reversed for granting a challenge for cause, but you can get reversed for not granting a challenge for cause. And Judge Weiss came back the next day and struck them all, even though in the record at pages 1362 through 64, volume 7, he said that all of those people subjectively can be fair. What Judge Weiss did and what plaintiffs did was
What's that record slide again?
Pages 1362 through 1364, it's in volume 7. This is where, on the one day, the judge explained his reasons for denying the challenges for cause. And the next day, he came back and said, okay, I can't tell the difference. I don't know who said what. I'm just striking them all.
But you're saying those were not true?
They were not proper?
They were not proper.
They were not proper challenges for cause because they didn't go to actual bias. They went to an implied bias based on a prospective juror's socioeconomic, political, philosophical
view. You still have to get past analytically the idea that the jury as seated didn't have anyone on it who...
No, I don't think
Okay, tell me why not.
Because if that's the rule, you can eliminate any point of view from a jury. And I've cited cases that say, you know, I would love to be able to argue that if you do this even once, the jury is no good. Because if you do it once in every one of 2,000 cases over a year, you've skewed the judicial system. And I do argue that in the reply brief. But the courts come down and say where you really make the difference is whether it's a systematic exclusion of a point of view. And here it was systematic, not just Mr. Walker. Not just the two people who said they couldn't do pain and suffering, but the other five who originally passed for cause, that the judge passed for cause on their cause challenge, that Judge Weiss then changes his mind and lets them go. We've cited the cases in our briefs that say just having a reluctance to a large number is not a bias. Let me give you an example. I have been in many times in this court where particular justices have raised an issue that could be a disqualifying circumstance, factual circumstance. Now, I've had it with at least three of you where I knew when the justice raised the point that justice was going to vote against me in that case. But I couldn't say, well, Justice Pickering, I'd like you off the Amoco case because you're going to vote against me. It had to do with the facts of the disqualification in that particular case. And I didn't raise anything on that because those circumstances didn't show an actual bias. A philosophical point of view is not the same as bias. And these people were not biased. And if you take everybody off a jury who thinks that $2 million is a lot of money, you skew the entire system.
Mr. Paulsenberg, I realize that this is your argument, but I guess the ultimate question is, even if it was there, was the client denied a trial by a fair and impartial jury?
And I'm saying that is not the standard when you have a systematic elimination of a point of view. You can't get rid of all the fiscal conservatives off the jury. That's just inappropriate. And I've set out the cases that say that. It is not enough, as they argued to Judge Weiss, and as they argue to you, that they can get rid of everybody who has a certain point of view and replace them with other qualified, unbiased jurors, because that skews the entire system. It's just like Batson. It's not an actual bias here. It's something that they're trying to create a bias. And I say that is structural error. If I got rid of all the day workers... And I used to be a day worker. If I got rid of all the day workers off the jury, that would be the same thing. If I got rid of all the people who thought the $2 million was not a lot of money, that would be the same thing. This goes to the essence of a fair jury. So I think it transcends. As much as I want to argue anchoring, this one is far, far worse than anchoring. Let me cover two other issues very quickly. One issue had to do with the experts. We have on the ADKT today an issue about changing the comment to 16.1. In the supplemental authorities, Justice Hardesty, I added Michael Lowry's blog entries from his very good blog, Compelling Discovery. And the reason I do that is because not so much that it's a persuasive piece of work, but he repeatedly says in there, why can't people just do expert designations the right way? Why can't they come out and say, look, this non-retained treater is going to talk about causation? That wouldn't be that hard to do, and that's the point that he makes, and that's the point that I make. We're in a system now where we've got 16.1 and 26 that says, lay out what it is these people are going to say. Dr. Muir went into causation when, honestly, there's no support in the record that he as a treater formed those opinions as to causation back when he was treating. This is
so why not do it at a deposition instead of a designation? What's the difference? In other words, between a designation or a defense attorney
that would go to whether it's harmless error as opposed to whether it's error. And realize our rule is different. When I was on the Rules Committee, I actually advocated that we shouldn't have to have an expert report, that lawyers can prepare a synopsis of what the party is supposed to say. And this court rejected, the committee actually proposed that. This court rejected it, although it does have the ability to allow the district judge to create an exception for a report. So did we know about some of the things? We knew about some of the things. We didn't know about all the things. We didn't know Dr. Muir was going to go into the causation analysis that he did. We didn't know that Dr. Gross was going to talk about it being a cardiological issue as opposed to a neurological issue. These are things, if we knew in advance, we could have prepared a case differently. If we knew in advance, we'd know what the strengths and weaknesses are. If we know the stuff in advance, we can settle cases. But the whole case comes down to whether we're going to have fair trials. The other issue that's presented here has to do with medical liens. I think medical liens come into evidence in two ways. First of all, if the doctor has a better chance, if he's treating on a lien, he has a better chance of being paid if the plaintiff prevails. So that goes to bias. It should be admissible. If he has sold his lien, that goes to what the real value of the lien should be. Liens, we all know about liens. Liens are a terrible thing. Doctors charge in liens amounts they do not ever receive in their real practice. That is an issue that should go in front of the jury. Your Honor, I'd like to save 2.5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. May it please the Court. My name is Ben Cloward. I represent Margie Seastrand, who is present in the courtroom with her husband, Doug. The first thing that I would like to talk about is the discretion of Judge Weiss in this case. Plaintiffs actually filed a motion in limine on the verdict amount. The court can review the appendix at Joint Appendix Volume 6, Exhibit 23, pages 0949 through 0954, to review the discussion that actually was held at the motion in limine hearing regarding the parameters regarding the amounts at issue. Specifically, Judge Weiss indicated that we would not be able to do a laddering questioning. He said, look, the defense can pick one number. The plaintiff can pick one number. You're limited to that. Mr. Jaffe indicated, well, I'm afraid that the plaintiff may say, well, what about $2 million? Well, what about $4 million? What about $7 million? What about $10 million? Judge Weiss said, I'm not going to allow that. Only one number for each side. And it's important to point out that the plaintiff had a reasonable expectation or a reasonable reason to question the veneer men and women about the $2 million. She had $900,000 in special damages. And so pursuant to NRS 16.050 subsection 1 F and G, there was a reason to inquire as to the actual or implied bias of the jurors in this case regarding that specific issue. Specifically, I would like to point to the language from NRS subsection F, and I'm quoting from the rule here. It says
NRS what?
I'm sorry, just Pickering. It's NRS 16.050 subsection 1 F. subsection F. And this states, quote, or it doesn't state the quote just yet. It says, a cause challenge should be taken when a juror has, quote, formed or expressed an unqualified opinion or belief as to the merits of the action or, importantly, the main question involved therein, end quote. And then if you move on to subsection G, this indicates, quote, the existence of a state of mind in the juror evincing enmity or bias to either party, end quote, is grounds for a cause challenge. Interestingly, defendant failed entirely in either the opening brief or the reply brief to analyze these two important sections. Plaintiff's belief, the reason the failure to analyze these is because defendant wants the court to apply a de novo review rather than an abuse of discretion. However, when the arguments are looked at and when the discussion is looked at, the questioning was very broad of the jurors. And if you look to the specific jurors, specifically Frazier, and coming from the Sanders v. Sears case, the court just recently said that if a juror's, quote, background is replete with circumstances which would call into question his ability to be fair, end quote, the district court should remove the juror for cause even if the juror has stated that they can be fair and impartial. The crux of the argument here is that the defense is saying, look, these jurors said that they could be fair on Mr. Jaffe's rehabilitation questioning. However, when you look at their actual backgrounds, it is replete with circumstances calling into question their ability to be fair.
How about the structural error argument that the appellant makes here? And that is to exclude an entire class of people. The example given here was fiscal conservatives. Would we allow the same type of exclusion, for instance, in a criminal case where there was death penalty? Some people on a jury may be philosophically opposed to death penalty, but that doesn't make them have a state of mind.
Sure.
That would have them removed for cause. Are we about to enter into that same area in the analysis that was done below in this case?
Well, I think there are two important considerations, Justice Snyder, that need to be considered. Number one, by, accepting the argument being advanced, this court would create a special class of citizens as identified as those who maybe couldn't award $2 million. So this court would actually create a protected class of individuals. That's not what the Due Process Clause and the cases cited, Batson and those cases, stand for. You have to have a protected class to begin with. Adoption of this position would actually create a protected class in favor of individuals. The second thing that I think the fine distinction that needs to be made by this court is that there's a significant difference between healthy skepticism and an unwillingness or an inability to actually award a specific amount based on not knowing the facts. I personally went to great lengths to not discuss any of the facts. The record is replete. And I think the most important thing is when the court looks to the actual statements of the jurors at issue, it is revealed that they have bias.
Why should we allow asking in numbers in jury selection, though, for either side, what Justice Gibbons said? I mean, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Why should we allow that at jury selection? I mean, is it a real issue as to numbers?
Sure. Justice Cherry, I think that, the Whitlock v. Salmon case indicating that parties should be able to intelligently exercise their peremptory challenges, that's one specific reason. But I think more important is contained within the statutory framework of NRS 16.050 subsection 1 F and G, which indicates that a party must be able to look to determine whether a jury has an unqualified opinion regarding the main question involved. In this case, the defendant stipulated to liability just days before or even the day of trial. I can't remember at this time when, but it was within the moments leading into it. So in reality, the only issue in this case was causation and damages. So the real issue was damages, with Ms. Seastrand having $900,000 in special damages to not allow her to inquire as to whether jurors would be predisposed based on their experiences. And when you look at the specific jurors, for instance, juror number 064, Frazier, he had been involved in four prior accidents. He said, I never sued anyone. Yet when I give a lady a, quote, little smack on the behind, she comes out holding her neck and forces me to court. He said that he had served as an expert before and was left with the belief that a lot of times plaintiffs are simply asking for too much.
More than the number, then. This guy should, if I were the district judge, I'd probably boot the guy too. But what about, why do you need a number to boot a guy like that?
Well, I think what Judge Weiss specifically said, and this is Joint Appendix Volume 8, Exhibit 27, page 1425, this is when he, after Mr. Jaffe made an objection regarding the amount, and Judge Weiss, we had a discussion about that outside the presence, and his comment was, and I quote from the record, I think that what the question was and what we want is we want a jury that is willing to award $2 million or $10 million, whatever the number is, if the facts justify it. We also want a jury who's willing to award zero if the facts justify it. And so not giving the parties an ability to inquire about the potential frame of mind that the jurors have and the potential, their leanings, specifically when the main issue in the case is that of money damages, I think that it severely hamstrings
the... How long did voir dire last? How many days?
Well, it lasted for... I'm sorry, Justice Pickney, thank you. It lasted for 3 days. However, there was a complication. Mr. Jaffe had a medical condition in the second day. I think we would have been done in 2 days, but...
And it's of concern to me, and I haven't read the whole record. It's not possible to read the entire record, but it's of concern to me that it went beyond just asking the question even. Assuming you get past Justice Jerry's point and say, okay, you get to ask the question. But it's very troubling to me to see citizens of the community who are as troubled by this process as the transcript suggests they were. I mean, they are, apparently one is saying one was crying and they felt harangued. And does that get into abuse of discretion when all those who took offense or umbrage at that were excused, even though they said, and I get your point on Frazier, but they said, well, you know, we could be fair, but we don't know the facts. It sounds like a lot of money. To me, that's troubling. Could you comment on that?
Certainly. And I think that the record bears out, number one, that the individual that they really pin their argument on, I was never admonished by Judge Weiss. Judge Weiss never said, hey, Mr.
Right, Flowers. But did he abuse his discretion in not taking a firmer control of this process? If it's to the point where the jurors are feeling abused by it, or the veneer.
Yeah, I think that this individual had a problem with being there entirely. And that individual had a problem with even discussing damages before. He kept saying, look, we need to first discuss fault before we can discuss damages. You're putting the cart before the horse, Mr. Cloward. And that was his concern. His concern wasn't, I don't think that I was, you know, mean to him. He was irritated that we were even discussing damages because in his view, look, we got to talk about fault first. And so
I'd like to take the flip side of the comment or question by Justice Cherry. The whole point of the exercise here is to determine what is an appropriate amount of damages if causation is demonstrated once liability has been acknowledged. What was the rationale for the judge in the motion in limine to set two specific dollar limits? I guess my question is, why shouldn't a party plaintiff be able to argue, if they want to go in and argue $10 million, they run the risk of being unreasonable, but why not?
Well, I think that Judge Weiss did use his discretion wisely, and he did see some of Mr. Jaffe's arguments that there could be a potential for abuse if someone were to go in and start with 2 and then move to 5 and then move to 10 and then move to 20. And so the parameters that he put on it, which were, you know, plaintiffs believe were reasonable, was to each party pick a number that they felt was reasonably based and go off of that number. I have just a moment, just 4 minutes left. Sure. I'd like to address the Howell arguments, if I may. Specifically, the defendant has the burden of providing a detailed record for this court to review. This case is simply not a good case to decide this issue on because the record is so undeveloped. Specifically, there's no record on what percentage of liens were sold, how much they were sold for, who sold their liens and who kept their liens. You know, there are really two main reasons that the court should deny to hear this or to extend Howell. The first is just a judicial quagmire that is going to result if the court does adopt this position. Imagine that juror speculation regarding future damages. You could have jurors who are allowed to hear about insurance who say things like, well, I understand the plaintiff has good insurance now, but I recently lost my insurance, so I think that we should award double what she's asking for. Another juror may argue, well, you know what, I don't think that's a good argument because President so-and-so was just elected and they promised to even make the insurance better, so in the future there's not going to be a need for this plaintiff to have any future damages. A third juror may say, well, you know what, my insurance just denied my husband's coverage on a procedure. That procedure or that insurance is the same insurance the plaintiff has, so I think that we should award an amount above what they're even asking for. Specifically, you'll have speculation when you have plaintiffs that have multiple treating providers, some treating on a lien, some treating not on a lien. You may have jurors who speculate, well, if Dr. Muir accepted 50%, I'm sure that all of the other providers will also accept 50%.
So how much additional time do you think this would add to the trial if you're fighting over all these liens and the amounts? Are we going to have sub-trials over liens within the trial, or what's your thoughts on that?
Justice Gibbons, I think that's a perfect point. I think not only are you going to have sub-trials within the trial, but I think it's going to lengthen the discovery time in general because you're going to have additional fights over what is the scope of discussion that's appropriate during the discovery. Specifically, you're going to have speculation about why the insurance company set the rates that they set. You're going to have speculation as to why Medicare is lower than some of the other health insurance providers. And so, in actuality, not only is it going to lengthen the trial, but it's going to significantly lengthen the discovery process and the process entirely. It's going to breed years and years of additional litigation for this court to consider, ranging from the scope of appropriate discovery all the way to the appropriateness of the jury instructions that are given at the time. So for those reasons...
So you would advocate complete exclusion of all that information at all times?
I'm sorry, Justice.
You are advocating then that we never discuss, we never fully inform a jury of how or where monies are being paid with respect to these specials that are being argued?
Correct. Correct. That is the position. I think that is the majority position as set forth in the Tri-County case. Justice Hardesty and I believe Justice Gibbons requested additional briefing on that case to determine the state of the law throughout the United States, and it was determined that the majority rule is to exclude, and it's for the reasons of the complications that I've just discussed. I have 1 minute, so I want to just address two other matters. Number one, this court in Armstrong v. Onufroc indicated that the reasonable value of a mother's services, nursing services to her injured son, were reasonable even though there were no charges that were attributed to her. So, you know, using write-downs and liens to determine the reasonable value are really not appropriate. And this court has held that in that case that you know, even though she didn't charge for those services, the plaintiff was still entitled to recover. The final thing is that defendants are not left without a remedy. Just as Dr. Schiaffini did in this case, he attacked the $146 charge of Dr. Belsky, saying that's not reasonable. It should be $75 to $100. So the defendants have an adequate remedy at this time to attack the reasonableness. And for all of these reasons, we encourage this court to reject Howell. Thank you for
your final point being that an expert can contest the reasonableness of the charges, and that's where you would have this debate shifted.
Correct, Justice Pickering, and the record on what Dr. Schiaffini did is Joint Appendix 23, Exhibit 54, pages 4406 through 4417. Any other questions?
Well, I know there were a lot of issues here, and I'm going to add 2 minutes to Mr. Polsenberg's time, but I would like you to take just a moment and comment on the expert issue that he identified. I don't think you reached the point, but I wanted to have you comment on that.
Certainly. Thank you, Justice.
I guess fundamentally, why not identify a treating physician is going to testify about causation?
Sure. I think the very first thing that the court should do is to review the record, specifically Appendix 23, Exhibit 54, pages 4420 through 4424, where Dr. Muir, in his treatment note, in his treatment note indicates, quote, "It is my opinion that the plaintiff's symptoms for which I am seeing the patient are directly related to the accident described above. It is my opinion that the treatments rendered thus far are reasonable and necessary in frequency and duration," end quote. In the specific case of Dr. Muir, in that record, on that treatment day, he reviewed Dr. Belsky's treatment records, and he actually spoke with Ms. Seastrand regarding the efficacy of the injections that Dr. Belsky had performed, and that's contained within the treatment record. Second, Mr. Harris did not only disclosed Dr. Muir and that he would address causation in the 16.1 disclosure, but during the deposition, after Mr. Jaffe's questions, Mr. Harris actually went back and said, "Dr. Muir, tell me, do you think that Dr. Belsky's treatment is reasonable?" Really, the ultimate complaint of the defense, after everything is pared down, is the claim that Dr. Muir did not come up with these opinions during the time of treatment. However, Justice Hardesty, when you look at the actual record that I just cited, his treatment record specifically states that he will address causation. Mr. Harris identified him as a treating physician who would address causation. And I'm sorry I'm talking fast, but I wanted to address the Dr. Gross issue, if I may. Dr. Gross is not a neurologist. He is a neurological surgeon. He's a neurosurgeon. So for him to be able to rule out the cardiac issues as a reason, or I mean rule out the neck complaints, as he's allowed to do that as an expert. And the Joint Appendix 12 at 4302 indicates that he actually reviewed those records, highlighted them, and he criticized their expert for ignoring the cardiac treatment. Thank you. Anything else?
Any additional questions for Mr. Card?
I have one question.
Okay,
on the disclosure with respect to the treating physicians, your disclosure said plaintiff's treating physicians are expected to offer testimony regarding diagnosis, treatment, and prognosis. The expert disclosure added causation for Dr. Gross. And my understanding is the treating doctor disclosure was never amended to add causation. Can you comment on that omission? You're referring to there being in the records, in the medical records, some reference to causation. That's my first question. My second question is whether or not the October 2008 consult was in play and just not asked about in the deposition.
As it pertains to Dr. Gross?
Yes.
I'm not certain whether Mr. Jaffe questioned him about the 2008 record, but if you look to if you actually look to his disclosure, he highlighted portions of the 2008 Dr. Cremani record. At the same time, he highlights the important parts in his record review. But the other thing that he does that's important is he also, at that same time, contemporaneous to that, he reviews a record that was 6 weeks later where Ms. Seastrand was sent out to have a cardiac stress test by the Heart Center of Nevada.
So go back to the expert disclosure, or to the treating doctor disclosure. Why omit causation from the disclosure? I mean, it's a pretty generic disclosure anyway, so I don't know how helpful it is, but I worry that it wasn't included.
Well, I guess our thought is that we did properly include causation. My recollection of the disclosure was that causation was expressly stated that Dr. Muir would address that.
The quoted one I have doesn't show it, but you're saying that it's in the record that you disclosed causation, that Muir would talk about causation?
Yes, that's my understanding.
Okay.
Any other questions?
I don't think so. Thank you, Mr. Justice.
Justice Pickering, let me address that quickly and then move over to the jury issue, which I think is controlling. There wasn't a disclosure having to do with Dr. Muir, the treater. There was that they put in an answer to interrogatory which listed 32 witnesses and said that they would talk about injuries, diagnosis, treatment, and prognosis.
But not causation.
Not causation. And what I'm saying is, why can't we just do it the way the rule says and set out a designation of people who are going to testify and what they're going to testify to And I think even if it just said causation, that wouldn't be enough. You should say what it is. Remember in the old days, we didn't depose experts because we had designations that told us what the experts were going to say. I'm not saying go back to that. Let me go to the jury issue. Chittenden versus Oliver. Justice Seda, this is not Chittenden versus Oliver. In Chittenden versus Oliver, you said you can't have a juror who gets up there and says, oh, no, I hate that bum, and then when Mr. Jaffe gets up and says, but you can be fair, right? That's not enough rehabilitation. And I saw that opinion coming for years. And I would have loved to have said in Chittenden versus Oliver that juror number 40 in that case had a particular point of view and so shouldn't have been disclosed. But that juror, if you'll recall, had been in an accident and didn't like plaintiffs. And when asked, you know, can you be fair, said no. That's not what we have here. Now, they're talking about a bunch of jurors. They're talking, saying the one that I have problems with. Well, they could be talking about Mr. Walker, number 34, who right off the bat said, you're putting the cart before the horse. We have to decide liability first. Clearly, the jury didn't. This potential jury was so uninformed, they didn't know what the case was about at that point. Or we could have been talking about Mr. Fitzgerald, the 10th one to be excused, who said, look, you're haranguing people, you're bullying them, you brought Ms. Ong to tears. And he was let go because he was having personality conflicts with the way voir dire was going. All right, even if we exclude those two, I got five others who were originally okayed by the judge, and then he threw them out because they had an opinion about $2 million being a lot of money. And they keep raising Mr. Frazier and the things he said, but Judge Weiss said Mr. Frazier could be fair. And even if he weren't that, I still have four more. This is a systematic exclusion of jurors who have a socioeconomic, political, philosophical point of view. Counsel says that I didn't even cite 16.050. I put it in the addendum to my brief. And I pointed out on page 3 of my reply brief, look, there are two different things we're talking about here. There's actual bias under 16.0501 F and G, the section counsel talked about. And then there is a circumstance that can be implied bias that are listed in the rest of the statute. This doesn't make actual bias, and they're trying to convert it into a circumstance that's implied bias. To be actual bias, you have to have an unqualified opinion or belief as to the merits of the case or the question involved. It's not enough, Justice Hardesty, that $2 million is a lot of money. It has to be, just like in Chittenden versus Oliver and some of the other cases, in Sanders versus Sears, it was, I'm being treated by the same doctor. I couldn't be fair. I would give that doctor a lot more preference. These are not circumstances that have to do with actual bias. This is a structural error. This is an attempt to eliminate an entire point of view from the jury pool.
A whole class of people being eliminated because they are conservative with respect to jury awards.
Very well said.
Well,
Mr. Paulsenberg, you structure this, but it's interesting because if I understand correctly, liability has now been conceded, so the only thing is causation and damages. Isn't it fair to ask toward that?
Well, no, I don't think so. I think the way it was asked, first of all, asking is a problem. Even if a judge is allowed some discretion in allowing
that's the only purpose left for this trial. So you should go into the trial totally blind?
I have three positions. First, yes. Second, the way it was done here was entirely inappropriate. And third, the argument that they made for asking the question was to use that information to use their peremptory challenges. Here they were being used for challenges for cause. And at that point, the argument jumps into an entirely different class. I don't really need Batson because Batson's a peremptory challenge case. This is the force and effect, the power of the state. The court itself excused these jurors. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, Mr. Polsenberg, Mr. Trout, thank you very much for your excellent arguments and briefing in this case. We appreciate your input, and the case will stand submitted. We'll be in recess for 15 minutes.